Welcome to the Glass Lab podcast, where we talk all things product development. It's our goal every month to introduce you to the people, ideas, and development tools that are shaping the hardware products we all use every day. Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of the Glass Lab podcast. I'm Drew Westrick, your host today and CTO at Glassboard, and I have Devin Campbell, who is the founder at Product. I am told product.dev, right? Did I get that right?
Exactly.
And then, as always, Grant Chapman, CEO at Glassboard, is returning. So welcome to the podcast. Thanks so much for coming out. We almost took you from the airport here.
Yeah, I just
pretty
landed.
Close.
I just so. Landed and I came straight here.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Awesome. So I guess first of, let's go intro on product briefly. Then I'd love to rewind and find out, what got you there. And then let's dive right into what you actually do at Product, what Product is doing, and go from there.
Okay. I'll flip that script just a little bit. I'll talk a little bit about me first because that kind of introduces us into Product. So I'm a mechanical engineer, bachelor's, master's mechanical engineer, and I've been doing product development my entire career since the 90s. I've been lucky enough to be in medical devices the whole time. Had some experience before that in optics and some in exercise equipment, but the thrust of my work has been in medical devices for the last 25 some years. When I first came into the industry, as an individual contributor, design engineer, in the trenches, designing real products that need to be manufactured and help real people, I was a very kind of curious person. I wasn't like the engineer that liked to just sit in my office and just, you give me requirements, I design to the requirements, I give you design output, and then we're good, and the transaction is done. I always like to get out of my cube and go talk to all the different functions and understand, well, what does it really mean to serve as a product? What does it really mean to manufacture a product? What does it mean to write quality requirements for a product and monitor things? And understanding that, listening to the voice of those customers, of my whatever it is that I'm creating and inventing, bringing that back in and kind of thinking about, well, how do I do product development better? That perspective allowed me to grow really fast within the first company I joined out of my master's. And we built the company to a pretty decent size, eventually sold it to a huge diagnostic player in the marketplace. And I stayed on for a while to see what it was like to work for a huge company like that after growing a small company to a medium-sized company and then having a massive acquisition. And I thrived equally well in that environment. It was different challenges.
Yeah, it's always like there's parts of it that are great, and then there's the stuff that you can't replace in the small
same,
size.
That's the same everywhere, yeah.
Yeah.
So I stayed there for a while, see what it was like, eventually got poached by their largest competitor. Both happened to be Swiss companies, so that brought me out to the East Coast for the first time. And I built a companion diagnostics business unit for that new pharma / medical device company. And I eventually kind of got a little bored, right? I am a mechanical engineer at heart, and we weren't developing our own products. We were using other people's diagnostic equipment to develop our own assays.
Mm-hmm.
So when an opportunity presented itself for a company in the Boston area that had some reliability challenges that needed a more experienced engineering kind of leadership to help them kind of think through how do we address them, I jumped at the opportunity to join that really small startup again. I was kind of like working for a small startup like where I had been a decade and a half prior to that. And it was a lot of fun. I eventually took that company public. So we had an IPO in 2017. And after that exit, I went ahead and it's the second of three exits I've had. I went ahead and started my own advisory firm, surrounded myself with other medical device experienced and savvy engineers and clinicians and quality and regulatory people and manufacturing technicians and just everything, and kind of give back to the industry and doing what we do to help other companies have similar success. And so that's kind of like how it introduces into Product, right? So that's what Product was. So Product was the creation of that idea to say, how do we give back? How do we help emerging entrepreneurs, very early stage companies, their seed, A, maybe B, how do we help them build the infrastructure, understand what is it going to take, the journey that they're about to embark on, which can be scary as hell, a really scary journey. You know, how do we make that a little bit less scary, and how do we help them understand, like, okay, well, we can do real good product development, we can do really good requirements, and we can do really good risk management. Like, let's help them think about it, and then hopefully have success.
Yeah. No, I love that. It's really scary. And that's always so interesting to talk about, like, in the startup space, especially in the hardware space, and then third tier in the medical hardware space.
Yeah.
Right. There's so many moments of what Drew and I like coined the valley of death. You know, when you're really early and you're racing, your pre-seed round, your angel round, and everything's exciting because it's beautiful slide decks and big dreams. And that's easy. That's the fun part, right? You ride the roller coaster. And you get just enough far into it, and you've raised just enough money to really get like knee deep. And now you're like, wait, I need to get to production, which is different than prototyping, different than, you know, just a value prop. Now we've got to make all this real and reliable at scale.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the fun part.
Well, and I feel like for better or worse, I feel like pretty much everything in regulatory still kind of feels like, in some ways, it's just like that knowledge is passed down from like, generation to generation, or consultant to consultant, right?
Or like, say.
It really is. I mean, it does seem like, I mean, obviously like your story very similar, right? That it seems like the people that have this knowledge are almost always the people that sort of learned it, as I dub it, like the hard way, right? Mm-hmm. Like actually taking product through the process, getting the battle scars.
Yeah, you
right?
have the scars to prove it. Yeah.
Yeah. And again, like I think, you know, firms like yours invaluable, right? Because, you know, again, as engineers, it just doesn't seem like, it seems like there's lots of information about lots and lots of things that you can go out and find in books or on the internet or wherever, right? ChatGPT now. But it does still seem like regulatory, whether it's medical regulatory or other regulatory, it still seems like there's a lot of just a lack of information out there, right? And you sort of almost have to turn to people like product or other companies to figure that out in some ways.
You could almost think of it the other way. It's almost like there's too much information.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? And how do you synthesize all of it?
What's relevant, right? Like there's a million standards, like which ones are relevant to me and my product? And trying to figure out that answer, I've never found a good way to do that other than talking to people in the industry that have done it and know it well enough to say, well, this is what you should be focused on.
Yeah.
So it's the nuance too. It's not just the letter in the paper or in the standard. It's the nuance. Is how do I test to that? How do I follow the spec? Hey, my user has this need. How are we testing to meet that? And that nuance of knowing where you can justify, you know, a thought experiment, or where you need to go do the real test with prototype, or where you need to go do the real test with the final thing, and how many of those fall into what category of risk, right?
Yeah.
It's that nuance that's between all of the lines, even though there are many. I agree with you. There's way too many for one person to truly know and understand all of them, but the real superpower is the read in between.
Yeah, I think another way of looking at that is think about the spirit of the regulation, right? So don't even get hung up on all of, because there's, you know, clause A, subsection B, subpart D, F, whatever. There's just so many different things. Really kind of take a step back when you're looking at regulations, or if you're trying to like educate yourself when you're looking at stuff online, whether it's safety regs or, you know, medical device regs, whatever, but just really look at it and say, well, what's the spirit? I mean, these are really good people behind what wrote these, and they wrote them for really good purposes to like try to help us develop better products, not to be jerks, right? You know, the FDA is not there. Other regulators aren't there to be jerks. They're there to help you follow best practices that have been honed for a really long time. So things like, yeah, requirements management matters. Planning matters. User needs matter.
Really matter.
No, really
those,
matter.
Those are the ones that really, really matter. Yeah, like if you're building a product that doesn't meet what your users actually want, but it might meet what the founders want, you're not going to be successful.
Yeah. You're in trouble.
Yeah.
I've worked on projects before that I've had to kind of clean up afterwards, and the device, the system that was there was definitely designed for the people that invented it and designed it.
Mm-hmm.
But then in the hands of actual users in labs, academic labs all around the world, you know, they would end up creating more problems for themselves, the users would, because it's not following, you know, their thought patterns. It was following the thought patterns of the inventors.
No, and I think that's such the fun part of, because Ben Ettinger, our director of product, and Christy originally worked together, and that's how I met Christy.
Mm-hmm.
But Ben and I were debating the finer points of, you know, how do you define this one user need as one product, and he used the spirit of it. And Christy was the one that taught him that turn of phrase. And it really changed. He's like, well, what do you want the user to think when they do this thing? Or how do you want them to do? I'm like, well, I want them to think like this. He's like, but no one thinks like that but you. And you really have to take yourself out of your shoes and put yourself into like all these different shoes, different personas, different shoes of how would you approach that problem? How would I use this thing? How is this useful to me? When me is not actually you, it's all these different personas.
Yeah, I'll say all the time with clients or with projects we're working on, it, you know, the engineers and scientists came up with these requirements. I'm like, we are absolutely the wrong people for writing these requirements. We're really good at writing product specifications. You know, that's a couple levels down, but like the user needs, we should not be doing that. We should be humble and going out and getting the actual needs of real users and expanding our thinking about who a user is.
Yeah, and I'd love to jump into that.
Okay.
So a lot of our clients ask, how do they find out their user needs? And when we're asking, you know, when our new clients, what do you need the device to do? And they tell us what they wanted it to. I'm like, well, have you validated this? Have you asked anybody? What is your recommended process for figuring that out? Because I completely agree, the engineers or the original idea founders are not good people to write the user needs at the end of the day.
No, we're the worst.
Yeah.
Not just not good. Hands down, the worst.
But engineers are just the worst. We're just the worst.
Yeah, that's just the blanket statement. I internalize that.
That's the hashtag for today.
Yeah, we are the worst. Yeah. But how do you recommend these, you know, nascent companies, early stage companies, go and get that information? Or what's that process look like for getting that, right? How do you not taint it with your own inputs?
So, I mean, first of all, there are professionals that go out and do this, right? So if you have the time and you have a little bit of money, you know, go find a professional to go and help you extract user needs from folks. I pretty much exclusively in product, we pretty much exclusively work with startups. So in that situation, you're grant funded, you're maybe one or two people, maybe five, six at the most. You don't have staff nor money to be able to go and do all that. So how do you do the best you can yourself, right? You're real smart. You know, maybe it's a PhD, a couple of students at a PhD thesis, right? And we're saying, like, let's turn this into a real product. Great, you guys are really smart, really hardworking people. Let's go do the best we can with the limited number of resources that we have. So the first thing I like to think about is obviously who's going to touch it, who's going to hold it, who's going to benefit from it, right? Those are very easy users to identify if you start coming up with user stories. Who's, you know, how is this going to help someone, or how is it going to be in the medical device space? Who's going to benefit from it? But you have to really be careful to think very broadly and not think, well, the user is the patient. Sure, the patient, it's, you know, it might be in them at some point, right? It's a, you know, it's an implantable, or it's, or they are inside the device, right? So it's like for in vitro diagnostics, you know, the patient, you're not in the patient. In most cases, it's a patient sample that's inside the system. But you have to think about, you know, the doctor, the clinician, the person who's waiting for the data to make a decision, but never touches the sample, never runs the process, never does any of it. You know, that person is also a user, right? And so understanding, you know, what kind of information do you need the system to produce, and with what level of accuracy for you to be able to make a clinical decision to be able to impact that patient's life? To really reach out and like ask all of those things, more than just academic white paper searching. Right. You can go find lots of white papers and you can find studies and say, oh, well, it needs to be precision of this to do this. Just go talk to people. Be humble, be curious, go talk. And write it down, record it if you can.
You just figured out the difference between screwing around in science is just writing it down. And when you're that early, the best thing you can always do is just write everything down somewhere or record it. I was just going to follow up, like, all of our really early startups Zoom calls, I record for them.
Yeah.
Because they don't have a team there, someone taking notes and someone answering questions. It's just them on the call. And I'm going to record that and send it back. I'm like, you're going to want this later to go over and figure out what you really feel about this.
Yeah, it's good, especially for the medical device startups. That's like great. Really early stage startups, one of the first things I'll find when I get in is they're doing great science. Not in any way they could ever take credit for. Right? Because like, well, where's your data? It's in a PowerPoint presentation. Like, okay, that's not indelible. Where's the data you pulled this from? Oh, it's on someone else's, you know, it's in the cloud, it's here, it's there, whatever.
It's on my Google Drive somewhere.
Right. How did you make that decision? Well, we had a really long meeting. We had some really great thinking about it, and we decided we're going to do this and not that. Is that written down anywhere? Almost always the answer is no, because as a little startup, that's not what you care about. You're not thinking about it. But I do a lot of work for VC firms where I'll come in and do diligence on behalf of the firm. And this is much later in a company's life, right? You know, that typically like an institutional VC is not going to come in really, really early. Sometimes they do. But for a larger companies, had some good traction, you know, develop some stuff. They'll go do the medical diligence. They'll do the business diligence, and then eventually they'll bring me in and I'll take a look at things. And my job really there is to kind of think about, you know, is this startup fooling themselves, right? Is the data here real? And it's so easy for me to punch holes through their data if they haven't just written it down. Because not that they're trying to lie, not that they're trying to trick anyone, but I could say, how could you prove to me that you're not?
Right.
How do I know you didn't cherry pick the data and show it to the VC and this is just the best data that shows your product's working, but 75% of the time it's not working?
It's just about following, can I go take your device and replicate that data set within about 10%?
Yeah.
Right? And that's always the fun, like you just see the color change to the people behind the counter.
Yeah.
And I'm like, no, I'm not going to be able to, am I? Or yeah. Like, absolutely, here it is. You're like, oh, okay, no, we don't need to do that because I see your response.
But it's not hard. I mean, it doesn't have to take a long amount of time, right? Just build it kind of into the culture is that when we make decisions, let's write it down somewhere. I don't care if you just keep a decision log.
We do it all the time. We hold the running log for all of our programs that it's just the thing you dump data into and like, oh, it's June 5th and we all decided we need to order purple prototypes instead of red ones because
yeah,
Billy liked purple. And the answer doesn't have to be scientific or good. It just has to be why.
Right, right. And then record the data in a place where it's indelible and, you know, it's defendable, right? And I can look at it and I can, oh yeah, I got to see the full data set, not just cherry-picked data set.
Here's the original data file that recorded off the thing.
Right.
And this is what I put in the PowerPoint, but this is where you can go and get the raw stuff.
Right. And it's in like some Dropbox folder that has write-only access.
Mm-hmm.
You just stick it in there. You can't overwrite it. And now it's super simple. I mean, eventually, if it's in a medical device company, eventually they're going to have to get to the point where they have to take all of that very seriously and build the quality management systems and all the infrastructure in place to make all of that completely defendable and auditable. But when you're really early, what's the spirit of it, right? Let's just make sure that people trust the data that we generate.
Well, and it's funny. So in like mechanical engineering, you're a mechanical engineer. So in CAD, there's PDM, right? Product Data Management.
Yeah.
And it has logs of, oh, who checked this file in and who checked it out?
Yeah.
And then you make the note of what change happened between it in the notes log. But that doesn't matter because you can get both versions. It saves both versions.
Yeah.
And that is so powerful because then you don't actually have to like make it, you know, it's in fact indelible. Like you have the whole design history somewhere. And data's cheap nowadays. Who cares if we're storing 25 versions of the same Word doc?
And modern technology is amazing for basically just that, product data management, right? I mean, whether it's Google showing, you know, every change or every edit where you can kind of go back through the revision,
sure.
Right? Or again, pretty much all of our verticals use some form of a product data, you know, management system, mm-hmm. Right? Whether that's software or hardware design or CAD. And to your point, again, it's what's nice about it is like you can go back and see, even outside those logs and stuff, if the engineering is actually being done, you can actually go back and see when those changes were made, right? Whether it's a circuit board, we changed that IC on this date and this time, you know, in the history.
Yeah. Like, it's not rocket science.
No,
though, right?
But it is.
Good engineers do it.
Yeah, yeah. But it is nice, I think. The one thing is that you had to set out to go do that, and I think that was kind of restricted for mm-hmm. much larger companies, right? Like, you'd have to be a company that could afford a license to, like, Siemens or something before you could really do that. Whereas now, even Glassboard, like a little under 20 people, like, pretty much, like Grant is saying, like, almost every tool or thing that we do has some kind of, like, audit trail on it. Whether it's in a in an industry that requires it, like medical device, or in an industry that doesn't, it's
just
still
practice.
Nice to have.
Yeah. No, and Drew's got all of our, you know, IT locked in. And my fear is like our YubiKeys, we have a physical security key we give every one of our employees is theirs. And only they can use that key to log in because they need their password. There's that two-factor authentication.
Sure.
Is in the hardware level. And it just gives us such security that no one's going to get in and alter that data unknown to us.
And that's another thing that's interesting about like some of this like auditability type stuff. It doesn't exist everywhere yet, but at least in software right now, we also, anytime a developer at Glassboard checks software in, it's cryptographically signed with that physical hardware security key. So again, from a, an auditability standpoint, I can say, and again, literally prove, this person did, like, they edited this line of code on this date, on this time.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just somebody that says that it was, or somebody that went in and edited like the log, right? So, you know, I'm excited to see that creep out more across all kinds of tools, right? Whether that's taking notes in a meeting or taking data for clinical type stuff, like whatever the case may be, that is, I think, an interesting use case potentially for, the ledger and even some of this crypto stuff is just in terms of like helping like auditability with even like the medical device and regulatory space.
So if we have any listeners though, watching this or listening to this, and they are startups in the medical device space, like take all of this with a giant grain of salt.
Sure.
Right? Like it's not like you have to do all these things right away. You're like a one or two person company. It could be as simple as you just keep a log somewhere where we say, we met. These are the two people that were in the meeting. This is what we talked about. We made this decision and this is why. Because eventually you're going to have to get to the point where you justify your decisions. Mm-hmm. There needs to be risk management demonstrated behind all of it in the medical device space, right?
Yeah.
We need to think through all the implications of every change that we make. So it's good practice to get into very early. But again, with all of the different tools that we have, yes, but you could also keep it simple.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be complicated.
Well, that's my favorite part about the new tech is it's no longer complicated. It's not like we set out to do all this nowadays. Like originally we did, but nowadays all of our software suites just do it.
Yeah.
And it's good practice. And I'm so excited that this good level of like, again, taking the data and putting it somewhere useful is very important. And it's getting to be frictionless. I remember when we first started out with like task management or project management apps, we'd burn through a ton of them because we hated them because no one would, at the end of the day, log in and move their tasks around and do it. Until we found one that was frictionless, and that's the one you want. It doesn't have the most features. It doesn't record the most amount of productivity data.
Does one thing really well.
But it does the thing really seamlessly and frictionless. Yeah. And that's what you want to do to engineers. You want to incentivize them by making it easy, because then they can engineer which what they actually like doing.
Right.
No, that's awesome. So getting, backing up a little, we got really down in the weeds onto, how we got there. But what would you say for someone that has never, heard of product? What do you guys do at a high level for our listeners that aren't in medical?
we're back in the truck way back.
We're going way back.
Yeah,
I'm just like, I want to, see what scope do you work on? Where do you tag in, tag out for those users that might not know what all those words meant?
Yeah, sure. We support our clients in helping kind of think through strategically and then help execute as well. We use resources to help build the infrastructure. But we think through, for medical devices, your product development processes, your quality systems that you would need, your risk management systems that you would need, how you integrate those three things, because they kind of can't exist as silos in medical devices. And then we also work on operations, and we have some small-scale manufacturing capabilities to help folks. If they have a small lot that they need to build, we'll build those as well. So we focus on those areas, and we'll build out a completely 1345 compliant quality system if we need to, but it's not ever our intention to be there. We don't want anyone to be dependent on us. It's not about us. It's about them and their product. And so we try to instill as much of our experience and our knowledge and our scars, into their brains so that they can have this product be successful and then go off and run another company and start up a whole another medical device, but feel confident that they know what they're doing this time instead of, the first time and they're really scared.
No, that's fantastic. And that's, I think, a wonderful thing that you guys have that is very close to what we do at Glassboard is our first-time founders or first-time startups we work with, we're doing almost all the heavy lifting, right?
Uh-huh.
Everything from engineering to program planning to management and suppliers, things like that. And then in V2, we're doing just the engineering and they're managing most of their suppliers at this stage. And hopefully by V3, we're just helping them in one vertical they couldn't find the right hire for.
Right.
And that's the end goal for all of our early stage guys is to get them trained up in all the things so they can go and run and do it.
Right.
Right.
Well, that's fantastic. I didn't know you guys were into light-scale manufacturing. Please do tell.
It's very light-scale manufacturing.
Yeah.
If a company has, they need 20 prototypes, simple prototypes. It's not like large, giant medical devices. Not 1345 compliant. And certified manufacturing processes, but we're all in this industry for quite a while. So, it kind of looks like, smells like, which is good enough for a startup, right? At the earlier stages, eventually you're going to go raise A and B funding. Then you can do like real product development and you can go do real manufacturing transfer and find actual CMOs and scale up to much larger. But we can do small stuff.
Yeah. No, that's awesome. That's awesome. What is your favorite tool in that toolbox for that small scale stuff? I know I was showing you around the shop earlier today, so you know mine. Forum Labs ecosystem is my, my hammer that hits most of my nails.
You can print yourself a pretty good size hammer with those.
It's nice.
Yeah. Yeah. No, those are great tools. And we'll do more of a buy and tie type approach.
It is.
Right. So we won't manufacture anything. We'll just do the assembly work.
Got it.
Create manufacturing work instructions, things like that.
Awesome. Very cool. So you go source, like if someone needed 3D prints, you go source a vendor that would make them. Perfect. Now that's
exactly.
Great. And managing that process early is an art form of knowing what vendors you should and could use at what stages.
Yeah. And if you're a startup, sometimes, you know, you just haven't had experience manufacturing a product or bringing it through yet. So it's daunting.
Is it?
And it's like, fine, yeah, we'll help you. Yeah. And we'll show you what we're doing and why we're doing it so that the next time you do it.
Yeah. Sit in the meeting, watch me grill the supplier on what we actually need, not what they're trying to sell.
I love taking clients on audits.
Yeah. Supply chain management is always underrated, is what I always tell people. Like many, 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 many companies live and die in supply chain.
Mm-hmm.
May not be the thing that people talk about, may not be the coolest of, you know, all the things.
Yeah, it's not the sexiest of topics.
No,
yeah.
No. Uh-uh. But again, when it's bad, everybody becomes a supply chain manager, right?
Yeah,
usually.
Yeah.
In the good times, it's the supply chain managers that worry about the supply chain.
Right.
In the bad times, everybody is worried about the supply chain.
Right.
No, that's good. That's awesome. And that's so cool. And I want to ask a question is, did you start doing that light scale manufacturing because you found that your clients needed it? Because Glassboard stumbles into these all the time.
Yeah.
You know, we started out as just an engineering services firm. Like we were just mechanical, electrical, and firmware engineering.
Right.
And that was it. And then we started to have to help prototype stuff. And then we had to help start making supply chains work. And now we get involved as early as helping build pitch decks and doing that thing. And I'd love to see if that's ubiquitous across kind of the industries of what we do. Because how do you decide what services you've been offering and how do you, you know, get into doing all the things that you currently offer?
Necessity.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, just working with these really early stage companies and kind of seeing what works and what doesn't work and where do they need support and saying, you guys need obviously product development, quality, risk management. Those are all very clear ones. But then you start thinking, you guys are so far away from operations, right? You're not there yet. But you're going to get there really quick. And now, you know, so we bring on operations expertise. We're all dangerous because we've been doing it for a long time, but I wouldn't be so bold as to call myself like an operations expert, even though I've transferred many products into manufacturing. I could probably do a pretty damn good job, but all of the intricacies of how does it work to really manage ops well. And and one thing that we focus on with all these teams is you're going to need this in a big way at some point. And if you wait until then, like quality systems, if you wait until you think you need it, you're way too late, right? You needed it much earlier.
We're going to have to juxtapose that clip with Christy saying that exact same thing on this podcast as well, right?
Yeah.
It's good. You're hammering that one home.
We're consistent in our messaging.
Yes.
But it's the same thing like with ops too, right? Like you don't have to do all of it right away, but you need to build with that end in mind. So when you're thinking through, okay, at some point, we're going to use a CMO. We're not going to manufacture ourselves. We're going to use a CMO to do all the work for us. We don't see building that infrastructure as being a value add to the company because eventually we want to exit or whatever. And, you know, there's so many world-class CMOs out there.
Right.
Well, you've got to go find a CMO now. How are we going to do that?
And I'm going to get them all to quote each other, but none of our requirements for manufacturing are good enough for them to all quote against.
Because we never asked them early.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, that's a tough one, trying to decide like when to start that process, when to engage with them, all of that. I mean, even at Glassboard, we ask ourselves that question all the time is like, you know, how far down or, you know, how many features do you truly develop before you kind of understand and know? Because again, different CMOs have different capabilities. They have different sweet spots. They have different processes that they prefer. And, you know, if you just design something as an engineer, you may find that it interfaces quite poorly to the manufacturing process, right?
Oh, yeah. All the time.
Right.
Yeah.
And again, for the most part, like it can be done, but at how many suppliers and to what level of good, right?
So let's go back, let's circle back to an earlier point in the conversation. We were talking about user needs.
Right.
Right. So think of your supplier
as
user. Your CMOs as one of your users at some point. Like I will literally write user need requirements that says, as an assembler, I expect. And then you can write out your requirements.
That's a great idea. I've honestly never heard somebody make that statement.
The front end.
Like, yeah, like consider them as a like user of the product. I think that is a really powerful way to think about it. I mean, we think in terms of manufacturability, right? But I would say that like my brain goes to a different place when I think about manufacturability than it does when I'm thinking about user requirements. And I think that's, again, user requirements are usually more upfront, which I think, again, makes sense because if you're already thinking about the production of the product up front and not when you're midway or 85% of the way done.
And you can do it without even having your product designed at all.
Right.
Right. You can say, we have an idea for this product.
Yeah.
You know, drop your ego, be humble, and just go talk to people and say, here's a sketch.
Yeah.
If we were to have you assemble something like this, like, what would make this really easy for you to assemble? Like, what would make this so that you could reliably make the same thing again and again and again? What features would you want?
Right.
And don't talk to the manufacturing engineer. Don't talk to the CEO of the manufacturing company. Don't talk to the sales team. Like, do talk to them.
But go on the floor.
But go on the floor.
Yeah.
And go to the floor and talk to the people who actually do it. Talk to the technicians, because they're the ones that really know.
Uh-huh.
And ask them. Everyone else's input is still valid.
Yeah.
Because they're different users. But talk to that person as well.
Yes.
And that's fun. I think the question I've got with that, because this is where I used to push back personally all the time on the early stage quality and planning and user need documentation, really, you know, early on in process when I was a younger engineer.
Uh-huh.
I've been bitten since, so I stopped doing that.
Mm-hmm.
So, but how do you juxtapose when too much writing it down is occurring and you're stifling product development? And again, it's taken, and I'm still not good at this yet. There's times you have to separate the two. You're going to write a user needs down that's like, as an assembler, I expect this to be, you know, insert thing here to be easy to manufacture. But when you're trying to troubleshoot the problem and develop solution, you throw that out for 5 minutes so you can think of creative ideas to solve it and then figure out how to make that thing manufacturable, sometimes the better way to do it.
Uh-huh.
How do you, A, coach, or B, think about where to pull those needs apart from each other? And how do you not stifle creativity while still writing all the things down? That's always the hard part to tell people that are new in it, that haven't been bitten hard enough to understand it'll save them time in the long run.
Yeah, I think a really hard part for folks that are new to it also is to not have the patience for how long this actually takes, right?
This is great. I can't wait. How long does it take?
It takes a very long time, but it's all time well vested, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's also a complicated time in a product development cycle for those that aren't like experienced in the trenches, because there's a lot of time that goes by where very little things are made. And people like to measure progress in seeing things. How many revs of the board have we made? How many widgets do we have? But if this is like, you know, a 2 year long project, you're going to be spending at least 30% of it up front, making sure you understand your market, making sure you understand everyone who's going to touch it, carefully writing down those requirements and thinking through that. If you don't think through it now, it's going to all bite you much later. And to respond to those changes later when you realize, oh, wait a second, we never asked any nurses. The nurse is the one who's going to actually be pressing the buttons at administering the therapy. We never talked to a nurse. And then the nurses give you they'll give you a ton of feedback.
They always do.
And then you realize, like, you know, we've totally missed the mark.
Yeah, no, right? When you've missed it, that's when you get the feedback.
Right.
Oh, man, those are not fun.
Right. So, I mean, it's a little bit of a gut check, right? It can't take years.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it depends on the complexity of the product. But I think if you were to look at it and then have, you know, feel comfortable with someone like me coming in a diligence type setting to say, you know, did you talk to people? And they say, oh, yeah, we talked to the engineers, you know, in the electronics bay. I'm like, okay. Did you talk to any users? Did you talk to patients? You didn't have to do like formal, formative human factor studies. Fine. I don't care. But did you go and talk to people? What are the sources for some of these requirements? And did you talk to a broad enough swath of people? And if the answer is yes, you say, yeah, you talked to a few doctors, you talked to a few patients, you talked to some nurses, you talked to payers. That's an interesting one to talk to.
Sure.
You talked to CMOs. You talked to your like a service team. It doesn't, you're like, we're a two-person company. We don't have a service team yet. Screw it. Find a field service engineer somewhere on LinkedIn, cold call them, just
offer
reach out.
Offer to buy them beer or coffee.
Yeah, and just say, hey, you want to meet for beer? I would love to understand what your life is like as a field service engineer so that I can design products that someone like you would work on in the future.
Mm-hmm.
They will be happy to share their feedback with you.
Yeah.
Oh, that's fantastic. And it's that, you know, ounce of prevention's worth a pound of cure. Like the more you end up working in product, the more you realize that's true. And I think that it's that delicate balance of how do you solve problems creatively in this workspace? And it's again, from what I've personally been able to do, and Drew, I'd love to hear your opinions on this, is I can separate the two in my mind, right? I can go into planning and product requirements mode and we have to figure this all out, and what questions I'm going to ask, and whose shoes am I going to walk into today to look at the product through that lens, and then go talk to someone like that to make sure all of our assumptions are right.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have to put on the other engineer hat of problem solving. Like, all right, I don't care how we're going to make it. We have to make the thing go this hot, this fast. Let's write out 10 bad ideas, test them all. 3 of them work. All right, now we find out which one of those 3, how do we manufacture them?
And you could do all that simultaneously.
Well, that's what I say. You have to separate it. You take the hat off, put the other hat on, and do those things. And you don't have to pick one.
Yeah.
You don't have to just be the guy that's creative, or just be the guy that documents, or just be the guy that plans.
Right.
You should do all of them. And you should internally knife fight yourself all the time when you're like driving, thinking about the problem. You're like, you know, personality A of me wants me to do this, and personality B wants me to do this.
I like the image of internal knife fighting.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it is. You're like, I have to solve the problem, but I have to do it this way. And you eventually end up like coming to a conclusion that, all right, one of you is going to be quiet for 5 minutes while the other one thinks. And then you come up with the idea that solves the problem.
At knife point,
always. Well, if it's not worth dying over, it's not worth doing.
Yeah. I mean, super biased opinion in the industry. It's what I do. But I do think that what you're talking about is what makes, product development or engineering specifically in new product space so difficult, is because you do need that engineer's mindset, that, you know, thinking in terms of first principles and how to problem solve and actually how to, you know, get over the hurdles to actually get a product that works, you know, from a science or an engineering perspective.
Yeah.
But then there is also that like empathetic side and like you're talking about, you know, talking to people and taking all these requirements and the human needs and melding that all together. And that's a pretty complicated set of traits, right? Like, it's no secret that, you know, a lot of engineers, we really like stuff and things, right? And engineers tend to be very focused on items and things, right? Mm-hmm. Not necessarily people, right? That's where the doctors and the nurses and the teachers are. But, you know, you start to look at, again, when you're trying to engineer products for people, like, you really do kind of have to meld all these things together. And I do like your analogy of like internal knife fighting, because it's like there really is a bunch of different things that all kind of have to, at different points in your thought process, sort of like take center stage, right? And so, yeah, it is. I mean, I think what you guys do, what we do, what other people do within this industry, I think at the end of the day, like, it is sometimes difficult to try to create that balance, right? Because I think it's really easy to get out of whack and think, you know, way too much about a user need that doesn't have any engineering feasibility, or something that's very feasible from an engineering perspective, but very unusable or undesirable from a, you know, a user need perspective.
Well, it's a give and take, right? I mean, user needs eventually get decomposed into product requirements.
Sure.
Or in, you know, FDA speak, design input.
Right.
Right. So, you know, there, you can come up with tons of user needs that aren't viable from a product development, perspective. And then that's a good thing. Well, we can't do that. Is that really, and then it becomes more of a business decision. Is that a user need, or is that a business decision? Do we want to do this? All of it, you know, it's a complicated interplay between, it's a dance between all three of those: business needs, user needs, and engineering needs. Like, can we actually develop this thing or not?
Yeah.
So, I mean, you kind of have to push back and forth on all of those.
You have to do all, you know, you have to be able to do all those things at once when you're doing product development, right? You do go get expert opinions on all those facets, but sometimes you just got to sit down and think about all those things and in a vacuum, and then put them back together again.
Yeah.
And that's my favorite juxtaposition. Like, you'll just quiet the other two voices and go focus on the nerdy thing or just the business thing.
Yeah.
So they can come up with enough ideas to combat the other one day.
Yeah. It's a complicated time frame, right? When the analogy I like to use is, it's kind of like, you've jumped from the plane and you're sewing the parachute while you fall, right?
That's good.
Like,
yes.
You're doing a lot of stuff and you're kind of creating, you know, you're making stuff up as you go. Right? Like, you're creating user needs, you're creating product requirements. Then if you think about it, it's like, well, why did I create this product requirement? What is the user? That's the inherent need of a user. Like, I might have said as an engineer, oh, of course it has to do this. But what is the user really wanting? And then kind of ebbing and flowing back and forth and say, well, I came up with this product requirement. It has to be able to withstand a drop off a 4-foot table.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I'm going to do that. What's the user need for that? And then you think, you know, go backwards. And say, well, the user expects to have it on their nightstand at home. Well, then that might make you think about, you know, in a holistic sense, other things, other requirements as an engineer. It's like, oh, well, if it is on the nightstand, there might be like cat dander around and things like that. And it makes you think a little bit more about your IPX ratings and things like that. And so you can kind of go back and forth and think the user needs to get decomposed into product requirements. If you came up with it bespoke, you know, what might the user needs be, and kind of going back and forth on it.
I love that analogy. Speaking of nightstands, I some days feel like that's how I get out of bed, is I fall out of bed and I'm free falling, and the day is literally just how quickly can we knit the parachute.
Yeah. No, and that analogy is great, because it's always, you know, when you're in the startup phase, it's juxtaposed against runway.
Yeah.
Right? Because you have cash flow. It's not coming in, it's just leaving.
Yeah.
And it comes in these big bunches or big bursts and moments that are very celebratory. And that's just when you've gotten in the plane again to go back up higher, and then they let you out the plane again.
There's a similar one that sometimes people use. They'll say like, oh yeah, well, we're building the train and laying the tracks while the train is running down the tracks, right?
Yeah.
I like the parachute one better, because in the startup world, like,
the ground's coming fast.
The ground's coming, but you're barreling down the track and you're building stuff. But if you get derailed, you know, it's not as scary necessarily as, you know, you jumped from the plane and you do not have a parachute yet. In the train, at least the ground is a couple feet away from you. In this situation, you really are doing it, because you have to keep that in mind. Like the folks, the engineers, the founders, everyone else is working in these companies. They're working their asses off. They're working really, really hard. At the same time, they're really scared and really lonely.
Yeah.
I think the lonely piece is an important one to dwell on for a second too, because a lot of times founders get other founders and understand how lonely the work can be.
Mm-hmm.
But you can talk to your friends around a bonfire and say, oh, yeah, I do this work. And they're like, oh, that sounds really cool. I bet that's really tough. But they've not lived it, right?
Yeah.
So they don't really honestly know. And you know when you're talking to them, they don't quite. So like this kind of work, medical device especially, but any startup, any idea, any venture you're going off of, you know, it's scary, it's lonely, and, you know, you got to do so much stuff all at once.
And you're doing all this stuff you don't know. That's the other part. Like, you were probably an expert in one of the things you set out to do, right? Like, I went to school for engineering, but I run a company and there's payroll and there's like benefits to give out and like 401ks to understand.
Right.
And you end up learning while sewing that parachute. And it's the most rewarding amount of learning you'll ever do is doing it on the job, doing it real time.
But you don't try to do it all yourself, right?
Well, no, you go find the right people. Like, we have a PEO that actually does all of our benefits and payroll, and they tell me what's going on so I can regurgitate that to my team and do the research on which one is the best one for us.
Right. You do a bunch of work and you realize, I kind of suck at accounting. So then you go get professional accountants to help you, right? I mean, the idea is, especially for startups, you can't do everything really, really well. You can do a couple things really well and go get professional help, even if it's just coaching and mentoring.
Yeah.
Because you don't have the time. Buy them a beer, buy them a coffee. Talk to someone once a month, surround yourself with really good advisors who know the space. We do an extraordinary amount of just kind of mentoring advisory work. And, you know, I might meet with a startup. We do so much bono work too. You know, might meet with an early entrepreneur, you know, once every couple months.
Sure.
And you're just nudging them in the right direction so they're not doing it in a completely uninformed way.
Yeah.
Don't find a mentor that's really nice to you. Don't do that. Find the one that will tell you your idea is ugly and tell you where it's not working.
They can do nice. They can be nice and tell you those things.
They can deliver it well. Yeah. They can have tact. Yeah. But don't have ones that just say nice things. Those are really dangerous. You get founders that have never had the professional criticism they've needed to challenge their internal ideas to push them to go do it differently.
Right.
And it's super important.
Well, thanks so much for coming on the podcast today. I mean, I think I learned a lot, and it's always fun to talk to folks that have done it, right? And are still doing it, right? Just maybe in a different capacity or assisting with other folks.
Yeah, helping others do it.
Yeah, so it was really great to have you on today.
Thanks.
And we'll catch you all in the next one. Thanks.